Jim brought in something very interesting. I'd heard this before. It's from a book called Pontiff. And it's a comment, John the 23rd talking about Cardinal Montini of Milan. John the 23rd had called him, when Paul was Archbishop of Milan, our Hamlet Cardinal. In a way it was true. He did believe suffering was a precondition for overcoming doubt. Not sure that's exactly a definition of Hamlet, but Paul VI was often referred to as the Hamlet Pope. Reason for that, a man who was indecisive, couldn't make up his mind, could be swayed in various directions, and had great difficulty doing anything in taking actions. And that phrase, the Hamlet Cardinal, turned into the Hamlet Pope over time. I want to just a brief recap as to where I left the discussion on Friday, in order to look at what we're going to do in finishing the play this morning. I made the point in looking at Act 3, Scene 4, that it is in that scene that Hamlet has his tragic fall. It is indeed the result of a tragic flaw. At the moment of his action, and the action is the stabbing of Polonius, who is spying behind the arras, that is the actual action. The tragic flaw at that moment is wrath. His anger overcomes him. And in this burst of anger, forcing himself to take an action, as I called it, an action without thought. He has not thought through what he's doing at that moment and simply lashes out with his sword and stabs the figure behind the arras and then says, "Is it the king?" Then asks the question. The blood goes on his hands. I guess we could say literally and figuratively. At that moment, our hero, for all of the problems he's had up to this point, now becomes a participant in the death that rules over Elsinore. He is now part of the deadly process of action that is grinding on in the Kingdom of Denmark. There is, however, I think, another flaw that we can point to, and it's clear that it's one that's been building, and that has been his own inability to clarify his thinking. It has been a process of loss of faith. It has been a process of loss of faith. While he seemed to realize that it was impossible to take action without having a reason for that action, that is, you cannot do anything if you don't have a belief system behind it, telling you why you should do it. What has happened is, as time has gone on, he has felt the need for action, so he has finally acted without thought, without faith, without motive, without understanding, and that action, that singular action disconnected from the world, disconnected from thought, disconnected from faith, is a tragic action. It is a lunatic action. He falls. And what we're going to find now, having fallen, we begin something of a downward spiral. There are going to be moments when tragic knowledge begin to come to him. That's what we're going to look at mostly in Act 5. In Act 4, something very different is going on. So with that in mind, let's look at the beginning, Act 4, Scene 1. The first thing that happens is the queen comes to report this to Claudius. He knows something is wrong. She's having trouble even verbalizing it for him. But he says there's matter in these sighs, these profound heaves. You must translate. His fit, we understand them. Where is your son? Of course, he somehow, the king in his wisdom connects whatever the problem is with Hamlet. He repeats, what Gertrude, how does Hamlet, and she characterizes her own son, mad as the sea and wind, when both contend which is the mightier. In his lawless fit behind the arras, hearing something stir, whips out his rapier, cries, a rat, a rat. And in this brainish apprehension, kills the unseen good old man. Okay? Brainish meaning brain sick, brain troubled. And that's accurate. His mother understands that much about him, that that's what's happened at that moment. And please notice the unseen good old man. It's Gertrude thinking the best of him. I'm not sure we can call Polonius necessarily good, but the point I made earlier, whatever his flaws, spying clearly the worst of it, certainly does not deserve the death which he is subject to. Claudius says, I should have kept him under lock and key. I was afraid something like this was going to happen. Where is he gone? The queen says, to draw apart the body he hath killed. Or whom, his very madness, like some ore among a mineral of metal's base, shows itself pure. He weeps for what is done. We get this grisly picture of Hamlet taking the body apart. But his madness, she says, is pure. And as a result, even as he's taking apart the body that he has killed, he is weeping. Weeping for Polonius, weeping for himself, we don't know. The tears, however, are a good sign. It's a little moment of hope at this time, when hope for this character seems to be gone. And the king sends off Rosencrantz and Guildenstern again to find Hamlet and bring him to the king. It's a little exchange again. It's very clear, it becomes increasingly clear of Hamlet's annoyance at these two young men. Let me say, we're going to, in Acts 4 and 5, have two examples of those who do their duty to the king. We've got Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are absolutely obedient to Claudius. He tells them to return from school at Wittenberg, they come. He tells them what to do while in the court, they do it. He gives them an order here, they follow it. They are, in a sense, models of obedience to the king, but again, what we see is, because of their obedience, they too are going to get caught up in this trap. They are obedient in Claudius's orders that Hamlet should be taken off to England. They are carrying letters telling the king of England to put Hamlet to death. That's going to result in their own death. They are going to have no idea what's gone on, what their role and mission has been, or the reason for which they are dying. Their obedience has been a blind obedience of such ignorance that they will have no idea for the remainder of their lives what has happened to them. It is a grisly reminder that the state of Denmark is indeed corrupt. Something is rotten in the state of Denmark, we learned in Act 1. It's gotten worse and worse and worse. In such a state, one cannot, the play makes very clear, just be blindly obedient. There is something very, very wrong there. It is corrupt, it is rotten. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are caught up in it. We'll get another example later of another figure who simply goes along. So if one example of where such obedience can get you in this case is simply absolute ignorance and being ground up in the machinery of death that has taken over Denmark. And that's what happens to them. We get an alternate vision in Act 5 with the figure of Osric, and I'll talk about him very soon. Hamlet accuses them of being just that. He calls Rosencrantz a sponge. And Hamlet says, I that soaks up the king's countenance. Okay? You'll just take as many favors as the king will hand out to you, and you'll just keep soaking them up like a sponge. His rewards, his authorities. But such officers do the king best service in the end. He keeps them like an ape in the corner of his jaw, first mouthed to be last swallowed. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but large monkeys do that. They'll take food in, and the cheeks will just swell out, and then suddenly when they decide they're ready to swallow it, down it will all go. I can't, how Shakespeare knew these things, we don't know, but there it is. He seemed to have access to knowledge of almost everything in the world. There's the very funny one-act play by George Bernard Shaw called The Dark Lady of the Sonnets that's about the young Shakespeare. And he presents Shakespeare as a young writer in London running around with a notebook, taking down everything he sees and everything he hears everyone say. It's just making endless notes about everything so that he could then call it back later for his plays. He couldn't possibly have done that, but he himself seems to have absorbed everything in the world that he heard, that he knew of. It all seemed to stay in his mind. A perfect example here, the way monkeys eat. And that image shows up here. He keeps them like an ape in the corner of his jaw, first mouth to be swallowed. When he needs what you have gleaned, it is but squeezing you and sponge, you shall be dry again. It's, oh man, it's sharp, it's pointed, it's very funny, and again, it's a truth. In spite of what's happened, he's still a truth teller. He still does have some connection with this world in which he lives, even though it is a corrupt and rotten one. Rosencrantz, I understand you not, my lord. Hamlet says, I am glad of it. A knavish speech sleeps in a foolish ear. That's just a second insult that Rosencrantz doesn't understand. They take him to the king. I'm not going over Act 4, Scene 3. We'll be acting that out tonight. There's one thing I do need to say here, though. There is a theme, an idea introduced in Act 4, Scene 3. That's going to come to dominate much of the end of the play. It's been hinted at before. In a sense, it goes back to the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy that we talked about on Friday, and that is the idea presented in that play, that the question of suicide simply comes down to a fact of whether or not one kills oneself, irrespective of divine law, divine purpose, divine order, because there may not be such a thing. And one possibility is that death simply is the end. That's it. There is, it's no more than going to sleep, losing consciousness, it's over, and nothing more. And if that is the case, then the body simply becomes food for worms, okay? Now Hamlet wears Polonius at supper. At supper where? Not where he eats, but where he is eaten. A certain convocation of politic worms are eaten at him. Your worm is your only emperor for diet. We fat all creatures else to fat us, and we fat ourselves for maggots. Your fat king and your lean beggar is but variable service. Two dishes, but to one table, that's the end. He continues it. It's an obsession. It's become an obsession, and we're going to see it grow. And it's the vision, finally now, there is nothing. There is nothing. A man may fish with the worm that hath ate of a king, and eat of the fish that hath fed of the worm. What dost thou mean by this? Nothing but to show you how a king may go a progress through the guts of a beggar. It's grim, it's very funny. He doesn't lose his sense of humor. But the idea is a grim one that's going to come back later. It's haunting him now. It's haunting him. Remember, he has just taken Polonius's body apart. And he's hidden it around the castle. He has treated it the way my father, who was a butcher, would have treated a dead chicken. You just pull the thing apart and it becomes a thing, a dead thing. And that has stuck in his mind and will come back to us. Claudius decides I've got to get rid of him and sends him off to England to be killed. Now, as I said, Act 4, Scene 4 is the first time we get outside the castle in Denmark, in the whole play. It is a play that is enclosed. It is so focused on Elsinore, not just the Kingdom of Denmark, but that particular castle, that it becomes obsessive, if you will. Whatever is happening in Denmark is happening in that castle. Elsinore is the focus of the entire play. This is very unusual for Shakespeare, particularly unusual for the tragedies, which range all over the landscape, not in Hamlet. Hamlet is intensive scenically in that way. And where we're going, we're off to that plain in Denmark where permission has been given for Fortinbras to march across this space of land with his troops on the way to attack Poland. We meet Fortinbras for the first time. We've heard a lot about him during the play. There he is. He sends greetings to the Danish king, wonders if the king has anything that he wants to speak to him about. We shall express our duty in his eye. We'll go pay our respects in person, okay? The captain goes off. Hamlet speaks to the captain, finds out who it is, why they're there, what's going on, and Hamlet is overcome with the numbers. Thousands of souls marching to Poland to fight over a tiny little patch of ground. This seems to be a meaningless war, but it's a war, and we have a huge number of troops on the march in that direction. And we get the last of the soliloquies. There's no soliloquy in Act 5. We have the last of the soliloquies. How all occasions do inform against me and spur my dull revenge. Basically, I can't go anywhere without being reminded that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. He's left the castle. He's on his way, he thinks, to the ship to carry him to England. He's walking across a plain in Denmark, and a reminder comes that he's not doing what he feels it is his duty to do. What is a man if his chief good and market of his time be but to sleep and feed? A beast, no more. But please notice, it's the first thing on his mind. If I can't do this one thing that I'm supposed to do, then I'm no more than a beast. But it's beginning to haunt him. It may indeed be possible that the chief good and market of man's time is but to sleep and feed. It may be that we are simply bestial. He doesn't quite believe it, and tries to make a leap upward. Sure, he that made us. It is, again, one of the few references to God later in the play. There is at least an acknowledgement here of a creator. Hugely important. There was no such admission in the to-be-or-not-to-be soliloquy. God was absent. Here at least, there is a reference. Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused. Man is reasonable. Man must be something more than a beast. We have reason. We can look forward into the future. We can look back into the past. There has to be a reason why we can do this. We weren't given this gift to no end. Now, whether it be bestial or oblivion, okay? Now, this is a complex sentence, but follow it. He's speaking about himself and his own inability to act. The first possibility he names is bestial oblivion. It might just be I'm seeking out the emptiness of the animal life. Maybe I can do no more. Maybe I'm seeking to be as oblivious as a dumb animal. Now, whether it be bestial oblivion or some craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, maybe there is some cowardly scruple, some cowardly reason that's keeping me from killing this man. Well, please notice a little insight here again. It's not just cowardly, but it may well be a scruple. It's a commandment. It's called thou shalt not kill. That revenge against his uncle is not within that tradition of faith at all. But here it's called a craven scruple of thinking too precisely on the event, a thought which quartered hath but one part wisdom and ever three parts coward. Okay, we take my thinking too much about this action that I don't seem to be able to take. We cut it in four pieces. One of them may be wisdom. One quarter of it may be that there is a reason for me not to kill him. The other three quarters is simply, I am a coward. I am a coward. I am afraid to do it. This is self-deprecation, but also please remember this is after he has already killed another man. But perhaps that has something to do with the one quarter wisdom that is now making it more difficult for him to kill Claudius. Blood is on his hand. We know he has wept over the corpse. Hamlet has had his tragic flaw. this may again be the stirrings of some sort of tragic knowledge. It may be he has learned something from this event. I do not know why yet I live to say these things to do, since I have cause and will and strength and means to do it. Okay? I've got a good reason, I've got the will, I'm strong enough to do it, the opportunity's there, I could do it, then why don't I do it? Why can't I do it? Examples gross as earth exhort me. All around me, obvious examples calling me on to do what I should, and he now compares himself with Fortinbras. Witness this army of such mass in charge. This is not a small group of ragtag soldiers. This is an army, massed and being led by a young prince, led by a delicate and tender prince, okay? This isn't just a buffoonish army captain leading them, okay? We don't have just a grunt officer here. This is a delicate and tender prince. This is a man of substance, delicacy. He has some refinement. He's intelligent. I can't pretend he's just a brute. No, sir. Led by a delicate and tender prince whose spirit with divine ambition puffed. What? He's a young man. He's an ambitious young man. That is divine ambition. That ambition is good. He's a prince. It's appropriate. It was placed there again. A hint by a divinity who gave us reason, has given us ambition in proper sphere and scope, he is suggesting. It is appropriate a young prince lead the army of his country to do the country's business, whose spirit with divine ambition puffed makes mouths at the invisible event. It's a wonderful phrase, a curious one. He is not afraid of any possible outcome and in fact will sort of hoot and sneer and make raspberries at it. But you can't go off and fight with that army over that patch of land. You might be killed. Okay. Makes mouths at the invisible event. Doesn't care about the outcome. He has his job to do and he will do it. He will mock any fear or on his own part or unpleasant outcome. Exposing what is mortal and unsure. There he makes the claim. Fortinbras doesn't know how this is going to come out. He may end up being buried in Poland. What a thought. To all that fortune, death, and danger dare, even for an eggshell. It may just be that fortune will turn her wheel and bring him down. It may be that he'll be struck down in combat by another soldier. Okay? It may be that he'll do some courageous action. And in doing it, be brought low. For what? I love it. Even for an eggshell, this tiny little patch, for what? For not much. For not much. Rightly to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor's at the stake. Okay? He's convincing himself of something. Doesn't matter how large the contest, doesn't matter how big the contention, what's important is if honor is at the stake, then one should rise greatly to that occasion. He is again trying to pump himself up, it's very clear. How stand I then? And now we draw the comparison. This is Fortinbras, this is the young prince, this is what he's doing, now let's look at me. How stand I then that have a father killed, a mother stained, excitements of my reason and my blood. My thought process has come to the point where I recognize what I must do, and my blood is stirred to do it. And let all sleep, but I just let it be. While to my shame, I see the imminent death of 20,000 men that for a fantasy and trick of fame go to their graves like beds. Fight for a plot whereon the numbers cannot try the cause. The piece of land is so small that the whole army can't fit and fight on it at the same time. You couldn't get all 20,000 soldiers onto that little piece of land. Nevertheless, they're going off to fight for it. which is not tomb enough and continent to hide the slain. If they were all killed off, there's not enough room there to bury them. But they're going off to fight for it. Oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. He views himself at war. He's trying to make, basically, through the comparison, in which he comes up short, he is trying to make the claim that he is at war with Claudius. It is an important war. He must rise, if you will, to the occasion. I want you to think back to the end of Act 2. There's a parallel here. Parallel from the Act 2 soliloquy to the Act 4 soliloquy. In the soliloquy that ended Act 2, he compares himself to the player. Okay? What would he do if he had the motive and the cue for passion that I have? Why, he would drown the stage with tears. Hamlet compares himself to the actor and comes up short. Here, Hamlet compares himself to the military prince and comes up short. Whenever he compares himself, he seems to come up short. But please notice the movement in terms of the play. In Act 2, he's comparing himself to someone who is simply showing extreme emotion. By Act 4, he's comparing himself to someone who is taking action in the world. It's movement forward, we cannot necessarily say it's movement upward. And each time, through the comparison, he is coming to some point of resolution where he's trying to convince himself to do something. Now, in the Act 2 soliloquy, it's to clarify his own thoughts and find out if the ghost was honest and whether or not his uncle actually did the deed. Here, it is to keep his thoughts bloody so that he can move toward killing the king. There are no longer any doubts about the veracity of what the ghost said, but please notice the ghost isn't even being mentioned at this point. It is simply the action that Hamlet feels that he must take. But we've gone from emotional clarification to spurring on to action. Those soliloquies are parallel and mark for us what's happened in terms of the movement forward. They're structural, clearly, end of Act 2, near the end of Act 4, in terms of their placement. But please notice the similarity of the final couplets. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. To this, oh, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. Okay? I don't see how this is any movement forward in the character. Basically saying, bloody action from now on. I will think blood, and that will lead me to act blood, because the only thing that has any worth in this world is my shedding blood. This is not the character who intrigued us from the beginning of the play. As if to make the point, and this is going to happen in the fourth act, and it's going to happen again in the fifth act, please notice what the next scene is. What does Shakespeare structurally follow this soliloquy with? Ophelia's mad scene. Now, I said when I was speaking about last week about Aristotle, and Aristotle's definition of plot or action as the most important element in tragedy, that it is through the structuring of the action that we come to understand what the point of the playwright is. That is, the playwright is teaching us something about what he himself, his attitude toward what's going on, and the way he structures that action. It was very clear in Sophocles' Oedipus. This is a much bigger play. The lines in it, the lines of action are not as precise. We have multiple plots for one thing. So it's much more difficult to get a sense. But there is the sense that Shakespeare will set things one against another for commentary. Sometimes it will be to deliberately overturn what has been said before. Many of you know, certainly have heard, even if you don't know the play. It's one of his most famous speeches. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women are merely players. Each player in his life plays seven parts. Okay, the acts being seven. Very, very famous speech. It's again one of those that is pulled out of context. The speaker of that speech in As You Like It is Jaques, the melancholy figure who walks through the forest of Arden, deprecating, putting down everything that the young lovers feel. He is cynical. There's no place for love in his universe. He's seen it all. He's done it all. He knows it. It's not worth squat. Why bother? And the All's the World's a Stage speech conveys that cynicism. We basically go through a progress, okay? And each stage in that process is not a pretty one. The infant mewling and puking in his nurse's arms. Now, it may be accurate in terms of some aspects of childhood, but it is certainly not a complete vision of what a child brings into the world, okay? The child is more than mewling and puking. But in terms of Jaques' vision, that's all it is. And ends with an awful vision of old age, okay? Where you finally lose everything and you don't even know who you are. Sans teeth, sans sense, sans everything. Just, it's all gone. You've lost your teeth, you've lost your hair, you've lost your reason, you really are just an old buffoon. And that's where you end up. You go through the seven stages, that's where you end up. The very next thing that happens in the play is the hero comes in with his old servant who refuses to leave him, even though they've been forced into exile. And the next thing we see is a vision of old age that is filled with loyalty, devotion, courage, self-sacrifice, and the speech is completely overturned. Any cynical comment that Jaques may have made is completely undercut by this figure of Adam, who is the most remarkable, loyal, decent, loving, kind old man that one can imagine. And it just blows apart what we've heard Jaques talk about. Now, it's not exactly the same here, but here is Hamlet saying, from now on my thoughts are what? Blood, blood, blood. And that will lead me to act and that will be good. The Hamlet-Ophelia link from the beginning of the play, I have tried to make the point, is central to understanding the title character. From that letter that I began our discussion with that he sent to her, probably from Wittenberg, everything in his world came to be doubted except her love. It was the one mark of stability. What we saw of that love at the beginning of the play, that it is that which is finally attacked by the generation on both sides, okay? To that horrendous, the very sad leave-taking that she comments on. Where Hamlet, this man of words, is so overcome with what he seems to feel is a break between them, he cannot even speak, sighs, goes out, and then the way he treats her, after the to be or not to be soliloquy, trampling on her, crushing her feelings to the point where she herself can say, oh, what a noble mind is here o'erthrown. He's lost his mind. He's lost his reason. And like bells jangling out of tune, this is not proper, it's not the way it should be. We must keep Ophelia as a barometer of Hamlet's spiritual health and mental health. So that at the end of the soliloquy, he may be training all of his thoughts on blood and bloody action, but we get the comment as to how healthy that is, I would claim, by what we have to witness next. And that is Ophelia's madness, which you put a good actress in it, it's devastating. Helena Bonham Carter in the Gibson film, brilliant performance. I've seen many, many a good performance of Hamlet where the Ophelia steals the show, simply by being honest and direct in the mad scene. It is overwhelming. Tragedy moves us to pity and fear. Ophelia's mad scene touches us more profoundly. It is more likely to draw tears than is the death of Hamlet. Aristotle would have understood that. We are there responding at the moment of Hamlet's death. We feel sorry, but combine that with the fear, the genuine terror of what's happened to this great man. With Ophelia, we must feel pathos. She is indeed a victim. Words overused now. Everyone's a victim, but I think it's fair to say Ophelia truly, in this play, is a victim, and that touches us in a powerful way. What has done it, we learn right away. Gertrude tries to keep apart from it. I will not speak with her. She is importunate, indeed distract. Her mood will needs be pitied, says the gentleman. Occasionally you have these gentlemen in Shakespeare who are unnamed, but he is indeed a gentleman, and his speech proves it. What would she have? She speaks much of her father. Says she hears there's tricks in the world, and hems and beats her heart, spurns enviously at straws. Wait a minute, in case we missed the point. Back to the soliloquy. But greatly to find quarrel in a straw, she spurns enviously at straws. She's not elevating straws beyond their greatness in order to come up with a reason for killing. She is spurning enviously at straws. Speaks things in doubt, okay? It's not clear what she's saying. She's speaking ambiguously. We can't make sense out of her speech that carried but half sense. Well, it's true of much of what Hamlet is saying at this point, too. Her speech is nothing. Yet the unshaped use of it doth move the hearers to collection. They're guessing at what she's saying. Now, the queen says, let her come in. This so troubles Gertrude, we have the only admission in the entire play from Gertrude about her own status, like son, like mother. In an aside, Gertrude says, to my sick soul, as sin's true nature is, each toy seems prologue to some great amiss. So full of artless jealousy is guilt, it spills itself in fearing to be spilt. She openly admits her guilt. It's a little four-line soliloquy for Gertrude. It is connected again with Ophelia. Ophelia is going to draw things out of these characters in the last two acts of the play. She is central. She is not just a small little girl who gets crushed. It's not a puppy dog who gets run over in the road and we all have a good weep over it. What has happened to Ophelia is serious. And her innocence is the core of it. She is hugely important. Where is the beauteous majesty of Denmark, she asks. Now, I'm not going to go through the songs. She sings song after song after song. They are on two subjects, death and love. Notice the first one. How should I your true love know from another one? By his cockle hat and staff and his sandals shown. Okay. Song of love. Betrayal in love. Second song, in case we missed the point, the entrance song and the second song, just make it very clear. Say you now, nay, pray you mark, he is dead and gone, lady, he is dead and gone, at his head a green grass green turf, at his heels a stone. There are two things that have driven her here. The loss of love, the betrayal of love, and the death of her father. And she cannot deal with it. As the corruption has built in Denmark, that corruption has first brought about a manipulation to make a break of Hamlet from her. Second of all, Hamlet himself has been the murderer of her father. The love that betrayed her then kills her father. It's more than she can stand. But the important thing is those two, the subject matter of the songs, those two subject matter. I'm going to come back to that in the next act. It's very important. I'm looking just before her exit. I hope all will be well. We must be patient. But I cannot choose but weep to think they should lay him in the cold ground. My brother shall know of it, and so I thank you for your good counsel. Come, my coach. Good night, ladies. Good night, sweet ladies. Good night. Good night. She is still civil, courteous, kind, although there are eruptions of small obscenity in some of the songs, having to do with the loss of her wits. Love somehow descends into that. The death descends into despair. But there is still that about her that breaks our hearts, in that we see that young woman who was remarkable. Now, that is followed by the entrance of Laertes. Sword drawn, going for the king. Let me just make the parallel directly. Claudius kills King Hamlet. As a result of that, Hamlet rises up and feels he must be a rebel against the state, okay, and kill the king. Hamlet kills Polonius. Laertes comes in blaming the king, and what Claudius is going to do is shift the blame to Prince Hamlet. So that Claudius says, this one I'm not responsible for. I'll tell you who is. It's Hamlet. But when Laertes rises up against Claudius, Claudius makes something very clear and says to him, what is the cause, Laertes, that thy rebellion looks so giant-like? What cause do you have to come in here openly rebelling giant-like in such large terms and with such high actions against the king? And we have another young man in the state of Denmark who is turned into a rebel. It seems that Denmark is producing rebels among all its young men. Wait long enough, there's going to be rebellion. Let the young man live long enough, he will be touched by something so disastrous, he will rise up in rebellion against this king and this state that seems to bring everything down to death. Simply stated, the state of Denmark breeds rebellion in the young. And now Laertes has shown up. On another level, we have this parallel. Claudius kills old King Hamlet. Hamlet, young Prince Hamlet, rebels in order to revenge his father. Young Prince Hamlet kills Polonius. Young Laertes rebels to kill Prince Hamlet in order to revenge his father. Laertes has been turned into a Hamlet figure by Hamlet. And in one sense, although it has to do with the whole atmosphere, the stinking atmosphere of spying that went on at this court, nevertheless, it was Prince Hamlet's action, killing Polonius, that now brings Laertes into rebellion. And Laertes saying, I will revenge my father. And he goes on to say so at length. Please notice his language. Let him go, Gertrude. Speak, man. Where is my father? Dead, but not by him, says the queen. Let him demand his fill. How came he dead? I'll not be juggled with. To hell allegiance. Vows to the blackest devil. Conscience and grace to the profoundest pit. I dare damnation. Now could I drink hot blood, says Hamlet. These are the young men of Denmark. And out of a crisis in faith, when suddenly they have a reason for action, they will rise to that action, but along with that rise to action, any sense of a coherent belief system is blown away. And they are taking on, Laertes here especially, who is not as bright as Hamlet, simply stated, is more of a man of action than Hamlet, so that his defiance of that old belief system is more direct. I dare damnation. Okay? To this point I stand that both the worlds I give to negligence, let come what comes. Only I'll be revenged. I don't care what happens to me. He's not thoughtful, but he is a rebel. Just as Hamlet became rebellious as a result of what happened to his father. Shakespeare cannot keep characters one-dimensional. And of course, the next thing that we see is that Ophelia reappears. Her brother is ranting like a lunatic. In comes his sister, actually mad. And it has its effect. The same character. Oh, heat, draw up my brains. Tears, seven times salt, burn out the sense and virtue of mine eye. By heaven, thy madness shall be paid with weight till our scale turn the beam. He's trying to rise to rant about revenge again, but instead we get, O Rose of May, dear maid, kind sister, sweet Ophelia. Oh, heavens, is it possible a young maid's wits should be as mortal as an old man's life? There is still enough decency in Laertes to respond. But please notice what Ophelia's madness is doing. It draws out of Gertrude an open admission of guilt, of her own sin, something that hasn't happened before. It takes the sting out of Laertes' desire for revenge, and at least calms him down a little bit and opens up the wellsprings of sympathy so that he becomes human again. It seems as if her madness is almost necessary to begin to get something decent back in this court. And this is a pattern that will continue in the next act. Let me put it another way. I've hinted at this before. Let me just state it outright. Hamlet is the one play where Shakespeare is on the verge of losing his balance. The play is so racked with doubt, so filled with problems, there is so much uncertainty, that it seems almost as if, in this play, he himself could have toppled, lost faith, and I'll tell you, there's a way in which if he had written nothing after Hamlet, we would assume, well, that was it. It got so bleak and so dark, the vision became so tragic, that was it. But what he discovers and what is in the play, the thing that is going to save Hamlet, and in a way, I think, saved Shakespeare from losing it completely, is that he can still comprehend the value of innocence, genuine love, and the way in which even the sacrifice, although an unknowing sacrifice, Ophelia doesn't choose to go mad, but in maintaining her virtues in this incredibly corrupt world, she does go mad. There is something slightly sacrificial about the character of Ophelia. And in her madness, and finally in her death, she is able to restore glimmers of good within the world of Denmark, and I think the creation of Ophelia is what saved Shakespeare's own balance as he went through. There is something there, and I would say to such a degree that it's not surprising that vision of the innocent heroine dominated him so that when he turns to the next play, she becomes the central figure, but her name is Desdemona. And indeed, she suffers and dies directly as the heroine and becomes much more central in the action. That's what he's exploring as well. That goodness, that decency that is there, that can somehow maintain. I'm not going to go through the handing out of the flowers. It's a devastating scene. There have been article after article after article written on the symbolism of the flowers, which character on stage gets which flower. This is the sort of thing Shakespeare scholars play with. It's a wonderful game. It's also something directors have to decide. The wonderful moment in the Zeffirelli film where she's got just little sticks and bones thinking they're flowers and she's handing, you can do all sorts of things with it. It is a devastating moment. It is a devastating moment. And even more, of course, ending that little giveaway by saying, there's a daisy, I would give you some violets, but they withered all when my father died. Horrible moment. That image will come back again. We'll find it over Ophelia's grave, as a matter of fact. And this is the last time we see her. Look at her final words. And will he not come again? And will he not come again? No, no, he is dead. Go to thy deathbed. He never will come again. His beard was as white as snow. All flaxen was his pall. He is gone. He is gone, and we cast away moan. God have mercy on his soul. And of all Christian souls, I pray God, God be with you. She's not so insane that she doesn't pray at the end. And the notion, the final prayer, is not just this vision of her father dead. May God have mercy on her father's soul. But it extends to a plea for universal forgiveness to all Christian souls. I pray God, God be with you. And off she goes, and we will not see her again. It's remarkable. It's great theater. It's such great theater, we can tend to forget the importance of what she stands for and what she represents. I just have a couple of minutes. I want to make two quick points about the final scene of Act Four. Laertes is filled with thoughts of revenge again, and the king is manipulating him. Word has come that Hamlet's back. He's back, okay? Claudius cannot imagine what's happened, but it's very clear that he's got a problem he's got to deal with. He's not dealing with it well. Everything he tries fails, so it becomes clear. What do? You let the younger generation wipe itself out. And he's going to turn Laertes against Hamlet and try to do it that way. Laertes gives a list of what's happened. I, a noble father, lost a sister driven into desperate terms. Okay, my revenge will come. I'm going to revenge my father's death, my sister's madness. Laertes is a long remove from that prayer that Ophelia makes at the end, but there it is. But Laertes convinces himself that he has a reason for doing so. The way we're going to do it, a fencing match, okay? We're going to set one against the other. Laertes, we learn, is a particularly good fencer. We know this because there was a gentleman of Normandy who shows up, very gallant, and he praised Laertes' abilities in fencing. A Norman was it, a Norman? Upon my life, Lamord, he's called. L-A-M-O-R-D. Those of you that know French, this Norman gentleman who rides in, who praises Laertes, the word is a synonym for death. And with this fencing match, death is indeed finally just going to invade the court of Denmark and wipe everyone out. However, we know that, because the report is made, when this Norman was praising Laertes, his praise did Hamlet so envenom with his envy that he could do nothing but wish and beg your sudden coming or to play with him. Young Hamlet is capable of the envy of young men on the sports field. Oh yeah? Well, I can do better than that. So we're taking again something youthful. Youthful. I can run faster than him. I can hit more balls than he can. I'm better at the foil than he is. It is a kind of envy, but it is the envy of young men, and Claudius is going to turn it to death-like purposes. But before that happens, we have the mark that Laertes himself is gone, and that Laertes will not have a fair fight, and comes up with the idea of putting poison on the end so that if he is scratched with all, nothing can save him. I'll touch my point with this contagion that if I gall him slightly,
It may be death. The smallest scratch will kill him. We do not have a fair fight. We're heading into a rigged sports event. It's worse than professional wrestling. The king then says, okay, well, that's good, but listen, here's what else we'll do. And comes up with the notion of the poisoned cup. As I said, we know Claudius is a drinking man, a heavy drinker. It's not inappropriate that his mind turns to death through poisoned drink. I'll have prepared him a chalice for the nonce, whereon but sipping, if he by chance escape your venomed stuck, our purpose may hold there. Ha ha ha. If you don't get him, I will. But stay, what noise? And the next character who comes in is the queen. She, of course, is going to be the one struck down. It's the second time through the play you realize the irony of Claudius saying, I'll poison the cup. Enter Gertrude. And what does she come to? And here are the two guys going, yeah, we'll kill him, we'll get him, he'll be dead. And what does the queen come in to say? Ophelia's dead. Her brother's so far gone, she can't live. Hamlet is so far mad, she can't live. This world of Denmark is so corrupt, she can't even wander about in madness speaking occasional truths. She's dead. Where in nature, the court may have driven her mad, but she goes out. There is a willow grows aslant a brook, okay? She's making crownlets of flowers for herself, crawled out on one of the limbs to gather flowers. The limb breaks and down she goes into the water and is incapable of saving herself. Her clothes spread wide and mermaid-like a while they bore her up, which time she chanted snatches of old lauds as one incapable of her own distress. And the water pulls her down to muddy death. Okay? Or to take arms against a sea of troubles. The sea of troubles finally overwhelms Ophelia and she dies. And when we next see Hamlet, he is also sunk to the bottom as well. That's the next lecture.